right, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Come on in. You can fault your own residents for the seating arrangement. No problem. Take them out later behind the woodshed when everybody has a crick in their neck from this. You can fault them. Welcome back. Everybody have a good weekend? Good? Ready to get back after it? Y'all ready to get saved today? I mean, seriously. I've had y'all unsaved this entire time in Romans. Y'all are going to get saved today. Some of y'all, all right? The rest of y'all ain't going to quite get it yet. We're going to keep going. Let's do some Romans this morning, shall we? Who would like to pray for us this morning? Enter us in. Somebody. Yes, come on, Will. Come on. Amen. Romans chapter 3. I want to show you a passage. One of my profs said one time, when the time comes that the savages come to get you, and they're going to take you away in the middle of the night, when a terrorist is going to come and going to come get you and drag you off, and you've got 3 seconds to rip out one page of your entire Bible. This is the page you're going to rip out. If you get this section of Scripture, you get it all. You get everything. Your entire Bible culminates in this passage right here in Romans chapter 3. And in many ways, this probably should be one of the most, if you're a writing your Bible person, this should be one of the most marked up sections of your entire Bible. There is nothing so beautiful and so deep as the text we're about to cover here this morning. If you'll notice verse 21, start there. Tell me where your first period is. Anybody see it?
26.
Nope. Went one too far.
22.
Back up. 25. 22. You see a period in 22?
Yeah.
Where? No, I've got a semicolon. We'll take it up with Zondervan or whoever did yours. Technically in the Greek, it's 25. Verse 25, after through faith. You have, again, point being, another long run-on sentence. Once again, Paul fails English, but it doesn't matter, because this brings about salvation, this passage right here. After being drugged through the mire so far in the book of Romans, and after seeing what it is that does not save, we've seen in chapter 1 through 3:20 so far is Paul making the argument, sin is what condemns. Sin is what condemns. And unless you can find a human being on this earth that has never sinned, that has always been perfect, has never had to apologize. In fact, the last thing they did was thank the nurse as she's turning off the life support. I've been kind to everybody their entire life, never, ever transgressed, and has the same holiness as God, then all of man stand condemned. And what he's done is he's shown you that's true with both the Gentile and the Jew. The Gentile manifests their sin by their licentiousness. The Jew manifests their sin by their legalism. But it's all sin. Whether you have the revealed law of God in front of you or whether the law of God is simply what you find in conscience and creation, man has transgressed it. And that is evidence of the sin that is within that goes all the way back to the garden. And so none seek God, not one. All stand condemned before God. And as I said before, if it ended in 3:20, if that was the book of Romans, it would be the most despairing book ever written in the world. Because you're meant to be screaming when you get to 3:20. How can I be saved then? How can I be ransomed from this if there's nothing that I can do? All my works are like filthy rags before God. There is not a single thing that I can do. I didn't even go looking for God. How in the world can I be saved? And thus, Romans chapter 3, verse 21 and following. And Paul is going to give us an assertion here of how salvation, otherwise known as justification, which is a term that means to be declared righteous, how do we get the righteousness of God that is revealed? How do we get that? And so that's what he's going to establish in verse 21 to 25. In verse 26 to 31, he's going to pose three questions or three interrogations about what justification by faith concludes. And he's going to tell you that when it comes to being justified by faith, boasting is excluded, God's oneness is exalted, and the law is actually established as good. And so we're going to see that in the following. And then what he's going to do in chapter 4 is he's going to prove all of this, not by a New Testament example, but he's going to go back and he's going to prove all this in the story of Abraham, how it's been justification by faith since the very beginning, since before the law, 400 years before the law. It was still faith, justification by faith. It's never been faith plus works. It's never been works. And so that's where we're going to run. Now, verse 21 and following, he's going to return to his argument in chapter 1, verse 16, that he was not ashamed of the gospel because it's the power of God to save, because in the gospel it is the righteousness of God that is revealed, that has been brought to us. And so let's watch him run with this in verse 21. This is what's called the doctrine of soteriology, the doctrine of salvation. Again, you can follow that up in the Moody Handbook if you'd like. Verse 21. But now. By the way, every major theological point Paul ever makes that leads to salvation starts with a big old but. And right here, but in contrast to what we just saw of what doesn't save, here's what does save. And notice the first thing he tells us here. What do we need to know about this salvation? How does it come? The first thing you need to know is, but now it is apart from the law. The law is a ladder that no man has the ability to climb. And so whatever this salvation is, however it's going to be brought in God's economy, the one thing you can know for certain is it's going to come apart from the law. Not under the law, not with the law, apart from the law is the only way you're going to find this salvation. And he keeps going. He says, apart from the law, this righteousness of God has been manifested. The righteousness that God requires, the righteousness that man needs, that righteousness isn't ascended to, but instead it has descended to us. That's the idea of 1:16 and 17, of it's been revealed, and then here it's been manifested. It's not you climbing a ladder in order to get to that righteousness. That righteousness was brought down to us. It was revealed to us. Otherwise, you would have not known how to get it. It was brought to you. It was manifested. It was revealed. Somebody outside of man is going to provide this righteousness for us. All we're going to need to do, he's going to set up, is behold it. And he says then, this fact that it's revealed, this righteousness that has come to us, has been witnessed by the law and the prophets. So even though it was not earned by the law, it was witnessed by the law. The idea of salvation by grace is nothing new. It's been there the whole time. Both the law and the prophets who prophesied about Jesus Christ in the Old Testament, they pointed to this idea. The law showed you the penalty of unrighteousness. And the prophets pointed to a Messiah who would come and provide it for us. That's why at the Transfiguration, who's there with Jesus? Moses on one side, Elijah on the other. What do they represent? The law, Moses, the prophets, Elijah. They both testifying in that moment, hey, this guy Jesus, he's the one. He's the means of salvation. That's why you have the law and the prophets there. And they all testify. And so in verse 22, even the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all those who believe. This salvation is going to come by trusting in something. It is by faith. Faith is what you do when you can do nothing else. It's when you recognize you have no merit in and of your own. Then you put your trust in something else that can save you. Faith is when you recognize your impotence, when you rest in somebody else. And in this case, who is that someone that is introduced again to us here in verse 22? Jesus. The first time and the only time we've seen Jesus in the book of Romans so far, we saw him in chapter 2. What was he bringing with him in chapter 2? Does anybody remember? Judgment. He was bringing wrath and judgment the first time we saw him, and Paul's argument that we are condemned. But here, the second time we see Jesus, what is he bringing with him? He's bringing salvation for those who trust, and those who believe. And he says in verse 22, for there is no distinction when it comes to this faith, since salvation is by faith, and it's not by your own works, then the playing field is leveled. Anyone can receive this salvation. God does not favor one person over another. If your salvation can come by your genealogy, then are some people going to be favored and some people going to be hosed? That's right. If your salvation is going to come by your human morality and how much you quit cussing or quit doing this or start doing this, if it comes by your morality, do we have certain advantages in some systems or not? Yeah. The playing field is uneven. However, if this salvation comes by faith, all I have to do is I have to put my trust in someone else who did it for me. Now the playing field's leveled. Doesn't matter what socioeconomic background, doesn't matter what class of race you've come through, doesn't matter whether you're some form of human caste system, doesn't matter that you come from this genealogical line or this part of the world, doesn't matter. If it comes by faith, then there is no partiality. There's no distinction from God. He doesn't play favorites. Anyone can come by faith right here. But why else is there no distinction? Look at this in verse 23. Why else is there no distinction? Because all have sinned. How many? Some? Just a few of you in here? All. All have sinned. This is in the past perfect tense, meaning it already occurred. What is this hinting towards? When it's past perfect tense, saying there is an event in the past that initiated sin and it has continued, you're all under it. What are we looking at here? It's going back to the garden. That's going back to the garden. Judgment has already been handed down somewhere else in time. And we know from the scriptures that was in the garden with Adam. All men are put into the same prison of condemnation because of their sin. And in verse 23, all fall short of the glory of God. Now, some believe here the term glory has the idea of God's pride in something, something that God glories in, that God is not impressed by any man, so man falls short of the commendation of God. Others note this has in mind that the very standard of God, and I think this is the classic interpretation, that his glory, his holiness, his righteousness in context, of which man obviously falls short of. We don't have that righteousness. You can't stand in the presence of holiness with that which is unholy. It can't stand to be in incinerated in the glory, in the light of that glory. So the one reason is there's no distinction when it comes to this salvation is because it comes by faith. But another reason there's no distinction is that all have sinned. All have fallen short. There's not one of us that is morally superior to another. We have all fallen short. Yeah, Andres.
I missed the first one. To fall short of the glory of God, what was the first one?
Something that God prides himself in. Like he would commendate this. Like God glories in something. And so he can't glory in you because you've fallen short of it. And some kind of that angle. They're both leading to the same idea. But I think this, the idea of glory is holiness here. But in verse 24, because of all of that, in verse 24, being justified. Now, this is interesting. Again, what does the term justified mean? I just told you. What's that?
You received God's righteousness.
Yeah. Literally, the phrase means to be declared righteous. This is a courtroom terminology. When you are declared innocent or when you're declared guilty by a judge who has the authority to do so, his declaration is sure. And so when you are being declared righteous, not because we are, we aren't, but we are declared righteous, then you are freed. When you're declared innocent in a court of law, you are free to leave that courtroom. The moment the verdict is read and the judge slams his gavel down and declares your status before him or before the state, in that moment when you've been declared innocent, you are free to leave the courtroom. You're no longer on trial anymore because we've been declared innocent in that moment. But here we're justified. We are declared righteous by the judge. Through faith, we are declared free. Now, how did this happen? The answer comes right after that in verse 24. As a what? As a gift by his grace. That word gift, this is fascinating. The word gift there is the word doron. It's the same word used in the Gospel of John about Jesus when he says, they hated me without cause. Jesus was put on trial without cause. That phrase, without cause, is a gift. It's the word doron. Jesus says, they condemned me and crucified me, doron, as a gift. In other words, when Paul uses it in the opposite way here, he's saying, you and I have about as much right to be saved as Jesus had to be executed. He was crucified as a gift. We were pardoned as a gift. Jesus didn't do anything to deserve the death that he incurred. You and I didn't do anything to deserve the life that we received. They were both given as a gift, as a doron. But even though it is a gift, that gift still has to be purchased, right? It's free to you. Is salvation free? Well, yes and no. It's free for you and I, but somebody had to pay for that gift that they gave for us. And by what means did this gift come through in verse 24? See what that says there? Through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus. Y'all know what the word redemption means? The most common word for redemption that is used over and over throughout the New Testament is the word exagorazo. Exagorazo, which means to buy up. It's used in Galatians, Ephesians, Colossians. That's the word exagorazo. That is not the word that Paul uses here. He goes even further. He uses the word lutrosis in the Greek. Lutrosis, which means to pay a ransom. The word exagorazo is the same word like you go to Chuck E. Cheese's or John's Incredible Pizza, and you go to the, what counter do you go to? You go to the redemption counter, don't you? That's what you do. You go to the redemption counter. What do? They buy up your tickets and exchange you a gift, right? That's the common word for redemption. That's not the word that's used here. The word that's used is lutrosis, which means to pay a ransom. But Paul goes even further than that, and he uses the word apolutrosis. Apolutrosis. Apo, the prefix apo in Greek, means to cut free or to release. What Paul is saying here is that Christ's death on the cross not only purchased you, not only paid the ransom that sin was holding you captive for, but he actually set you free. Free from the captivity that you and I were in. So the reason that you and I can be saved is because someone else transacted a payment that not only purchased us, not only paid a ransom, but actually released us into a freedom that you and I could never find for ourselves. It is liberation, is what it is. Now, chapter 6 is going to expand on this whole idea in detail, but in a nutshell, here's the importance. Remember that total depravity that you and I were under when Paul uses the phrase under sin? We were under that captivity. Like a prisoner, we could do no good thing on our own. We were slaves to that king. Well, when Christ comes along, he frees us to a new king that now we can serve him. We're free to serve him. We're not free just so we can go sin all we want. We're free to obey in a way that we never could when we were under the bondage of sin. There is a whole new power source that's given here. We'll deal with that in chapter 6 in detail. Now, what was this payment? Keep reading there in verse 24. The payment wasn't a what, but the payment was a who. The redemption which is in who? Jesus Christ. When you and I violated God with our sin, we were immediately in debt. We were prisoners to sin and death. We were children of the devil, and no payment of our own selves could get us out. We owed too much. But God made the payment for us. He paid the ransom for us. And the currency he used wasn't any silver or gold. The currency, as Peter illustrates in 1 Peter, the currency was his own son. His own son. That was the payment that purchased for us the gift of salvation, which is now the judge declaring us righteous, not because of what we've done, but because of what his payment did, his son Jesus Christ, so that we no longer fall short of the glory of God, but the righteousness of God can now be found in us as a gift. Let me ask you something. Can Buddha buy you this gift? No. Can Muhammad buy you this gift? No. Can Joseph Smith and his tablets buy you this gift? No. Can your own Catholic merit and sacrament buy you this gift? No. This is a gift that has only been purchased by God through Jesus Christ alone. Only Jesus can make this payment for you. Nothing else can make this payment. That's why Jesus said in John 14:6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one gets to the Father except through me. So, if Jesus was the actual payment, where was that payment transacted? What was the actual mechanism? Think ATM here. If you're going to receive this money and it's transacted through a mechanism, what was the mechanism in which this currency was transacted to pay our ransom and set us free? See what it is there in verse 25? Whom God displayed publicly. Now you got to do a little bit of a digging here. What was it that displayed Jesus publicly? The cross. The cross, the crucifix, is the ATM that dispensed the payment, which was Christ's blood. That was it. More specifically here, what are we talking about? What happens on a cross? What do you do on a cross, ultimately? You die. Death, in specificity, death is the payment that transacted. What was the penalty for our sin, according to Genesis chapter 3? Death. So what was the payment that took the substitute for us? Death. That's what Jesus did. Unless there was a substitute who could take that penalty of sin for you, but not just any substitute, couldn't be another human being, definitely couldn't be a sheep or a goat, that didn't work. It had to be a holy, blameless human being. One who was perfectly God and perfectly man. Someone who had never violated God's law like we had. Does that human exist in the world? No. So God had to send him. This is the whole idea. Remember when I shared with you that California court illustration? I shared that with you about the girl who got the traffic ticket and had to go to court against her own dad. Y'all remember that? Yes? No? Some of y'all don't know? Let me repeat. There is a true story. It's like 1970s, whatever, where a girl goes into fight a traffic ticket, and she had to fight the traffic ticket against her own dad. He was the judge. And this was back in a day before we had nepotism laws, in effect, like we have now. And the media caught wind of it. Remember, the media comes in, and they're going to capture this deal because what's this dad going to do? How in the world? You know, it's his daughter. I mean, this weird scene of, in one sense, flesh and blood, man, that's his girl. Loves her. Doesn't want her to suffer the consequences of her transgression. But he's also the judge. He's been appointed by the state of California to carry out the laws of California and make sure justice happens, lest he not be a just judge. So what's he going to do? So here's the story, remember? She pleads her case about how I didn't see this and I didn't know this. And they go and they put all the evidence out and she's guilty as sin. And so that awkward, tense moment when he reads the verdict, slams the gavel, she's guilty, something like a $200 fine or a couple days in prison. Couple days in jail. And she starts weeping, and the dad's choking up as the judge, because as a father, he recognizes his girl don't have no $200. he don't want her going to jail either. So what do you do? This is where the tension of who God is comes into play. How can a loving God, right? That's the question. How do you wrestle with the love and the justice of God? It's in Jesus Christ that both are satisfied. In the same way, what that dad did is he stood up from the bench after saying guilty. He took off his robe, and he walked down, and he pulled out his checkbook, and he wrote the penalty for her and freed her. And in that moment, that California judge satisfied the justice of the judge seat and the love of the Father. How do you wrestle with those? Jesus Christ. That's what God did. Jesus Christ, without ceasing to be God, did not regard equality with God as something he had to hold on to. But he emptied himself. He took off that robe, not taking off his deity, but simply suspending what was rightfully his so he could go down and pay the payment that you and I deserved. And in that moment, he satisfies both the justice and the love of God. Only Jesus can do that, by the way. There's no other solution where both the justice of God and the love of God are satisfied in the same moment. But in that moment it is with Jesus Christ. And so the same is true here. Except instead of violating a county court, you and I sinned against God. And instead of being penalized with a $200 fine, we were penalized with death. Both physical separation from God and alienation, and eternal separation from God and alienation. And instead of a payment with a check, The payment had to be in blood. Yeah.
So what all was required, like, for that sacrifice to be eternal? So, like, one of them, it had to have been, like, a perfect sacrifice, right?
Yeah. Perfect in that it was holy and blameless. That's why no lamb could do. It was all a temporal system. That's what the entire book of Hebrews is about, is how Jesus is our perfect priest. He's our perfect sacrifice. And only his, she had to have shed blood, had blood covenant, had to happen. And so it had to be the shed blood of someone who is holy and righteous. And no other human and no animal could sacrifice that for us. We were all under sin. That's why there had to be a virgin birth. Because when we get to the doctrine of imputation, and we'll see that here in another two chapters, when we get to the doctrine of imputation, Jesus couldn't come through the seed of man. He came through the seed of God, through woman. And so there had to be a virgin birth. That's why the virgin birth, according to Rob Bell, is not just some brick you pull out of a wall and you don't need it and the whole thing stands. It all falls apart without it. There has to be a 100% God, 100% man, blood sacrifice for us that was appeasing to God, that appeases God. So hold on, because we're going to look more at that in the very next word that's coming. Because here, God displayed him publicly on a cross. That was his death. And here is the word that rocks this whole text right here. How was he displayed? As a what? What's your next word in verse 25? Propitiation. Ready for a big seminary word right here? Propitiation. This one is fascinating. The word that's used there is the word hilaskomai. It means to bring full satisfaction, to appease. Now, what was it that needed to be appeased according to chapter 2, verse 8? His wrath. His wrath. The wrath of God is what was revealed in man, according to 1:18. And the wrath of God is what needed to be appeased, according to chapter 2, verse 8. In a sense, this was the ransom demand. God could not forgive you unless there is a substitutionary death in your place that both made you holy and righteous and satisfy the wrath or the judgment of God, which was manifest in death. There had to be a blood payment. Now, here's where your Old Testament comes in. The word hilaskomai comes from the root halasmos in the Greek. The translation of the word halasmos, if you were to try to translate that Greek word into Hebrew, do you know what the word is? The word that we get, mercy seat. Does anybody remember the mercy seat from the book of Leviticus? Leviticus chapter 16. On the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, the one day of the year that the high priest would enter into the Holy of Holies, and he would go to the altar there. And he would stand before the Ark of the Covenant after an unblemished lamb was slain. And he would take the blood of that lamb into the Holy of Holies. And there you had the Ark of the Covenant. Now, you're going to forgive my artistry here. It is so beautiful. I'm just going to tell you that. So here you got the Ark of the Covenant. And on the Ark of the Covenant, you got your little angel right here. Forgive that. I don't even know. Just going that way. All right. Your little cherubs, whatever you got over there, sitting over there, seraphim. And you have your Ark of the Covenant. Now, what was inside the Ark of the Covenant? Several artifacts are in there. What was the most notable of all? The Ten Commandments, right? Okay. Yeah, the Ten Commandments. What did they represent? Yeah. They represented the law of God, but more specifically, what do they represent?
Broken law.
The broken law. Man's sin. is what they represented. Above the Ark of the Covenant, the Holy Holies, what resided above the Ark of the Covenant? Anybody know?
Mercy seat.
No? What was above the Ark of the Covenant?
Tabernacle.
Nope.
Of pillars.
No.
Pillars of smoke.
I love this. You're getting closer. It's the word, starts with a G and ends with an odd. Okay? God. Otherwise known as the Shekinah glory. Okay, the Shekinah glory. This was the presence of God in the Holy of Holies. This was where he dwelt. And his presence hovered above the Ark of the Covenant. That's why you have angels here with their wings spread out. They can't even look upon it. They can't even see the glory of God. It's too glorious. And so they're there, and they're trying to shield man's sin, but man's sin cannot escape from the presence of God. And the wrath of God is what is upon man's sin. But there's something that lies between it. What is that? Right here. This is known as the mercy seat. This is the slab of gold that was on top of the Ark of the Covenant. And what the high priest would do is he would come in and he would take the blood of the unblemished lamb and he would sprinkle it seven times over the mercy seat. And that blood, what would it do? It would do two things. It would cover man's sin. What's our word we have for that? Anybody know? Huh?
Atone.
Atone. That is atonement. It means to cover. It covered man's sin. But that blood did something else. It mercy seated the wrath of God. It halosmosed, in the Greek, the wrath of God. It propitiated, meaning it satisfied the wrath of God. That is the idea of propitiation. It brought full satisfaction. When Jesus died on the cross, Jesus did two primary things for you in your sin. The first thing he did by his blood is he atoned for our sin. Jesus' blood covers our sin, and through faith in Jesus Christ, his righteousness is imputed to us, to our account. So no longer does God see our sin anymore. It has been atoned for. It's been covered. But the wrath of God that was upon us, Jesus took that upon himself. And he died in our place. And when he died, when he shed his blood, he not only atoned for our sin, but he satisfied the wrath of God. Do you understand that? Do you understand if you're a child of God right now, if your faith is in Jesus Christ, God is not mad at you right now? Do you understand that? Do you understand that his wrath has been fully satisfied? That you're not on a treadmill right now trying to perform for God so that he'll be happy with you in your performance? If you've been around the well, you've heard me say this over and over and over again. There is nothing that you can do to make God love you any more than he already does. And there is nothing that you can do to make God love you any less. Because he doesn't love you based on your performance. He loves you based on the performance of his son, who is perfect. Perfect atonement, perfect propitiation. He satisfied the wrath of God for us. Once and for all. Yeah.
So was the Ark of the Covenant just covered in blood?
Yeah.
So there's no, like, it doesn't ever say, like, oh, they cleaned the Ark.
Yeah.
It was just like a box of gold covered in blood, right?
Yeah. But tell me this. Did that ultimately satisfy the wrath of God? Did that blood of that goat or that lamb, did that ultimately satisfy it?
No.
No. Why? How do you know?
Jesus had to.
Well, I'll tell you this, because he had to do it again next year. Every Yom Kippur, you had to go do that. So, never. Why? Because evidently we had a year. You had a year span on that? Is that how that works? Actually, no. You had about a 1 second span, right? It was all pointing to Christ. But yeah, to your point, pretty messy. Yeah, blood's a messy thing. If you ever get the chance to go to Israel, you walk around the Temple Mount, you walk through the places where they did the sacrifices, and it's almost as if you can still sense the stench. I mean, it's just, always blood. And this was just Yom Kippur. You still had daily sacrifices and offerings that were happening every day. This was for the atonement of the nation. It's a pretty nasty thing. But Jesus shed his blood so that you and I could, that ransom could be paid and we could be cut free. So we could enjoy the righteousness of God that comes by faith. And so, he was displayed publicly as a propitiation in his blood. Why did it have to be blood? Because when you get an animal's blood, you get an animal's life. It's the reason why we couldn't just take an ear. Take an ear of an animal and he's deaf. Take a leg of an animal and he's crippled. Take the blood of an animal, you take his life. That's the idea of blood. Death was the penalty. In the day that you eat of this tree, surely you will die, emphatically in the Hebrew. You will die. So life had to be removed by its blood, because that was what God demanded, a life for a life. Thus, Jesus could not merely be beaten for our transgressions. He had to be crucified for our transgressions. Prior to Christ, that sacrificial system was set up where sins would be temporarily atoned for, but never eternally, never permanently. So 7 times I was sprinkled on that seat, covering it. And in that moment, God's wrath was hilaskomai. It was propitiated. It was satisfied. Now, how do we know, by the way, that Christ's sacrifice was once for all? I mean, I asked you, how do you know that this didn't work? How do you know that Christ did? Yeah, several things. One, Jesus' own words. What did he say at the very end? Tetelestai. It is finished. It is finished. Jesus, as our high priest, declared there ain't no more sacrifices. He validated it by his resurrection. Paul tells us this over and over in his epistles and we've seen in the book of Acts. His resurrection is what validated that he overcame death for us. And the fact that the veil tore, it's the most beautiful, one of the most beautiful pieces in the resurrection account, or in the crucifixion account, is the veil of the tabernacle. That veil that separated all this, you couldn't even go in there, only the high priest. That sucker tore so that the presence of God is no longer removed from his people. And now through faith dwells within us. So, now, right here, in the middle of 25, Paul picks back up where he left off at the start of 24. Remember in verse 24, he starts off by telling us that we are justified as a gift. Then he pauses to tell us how that justification process took place in Jesus. But now he uses a phrase to explain to us how we go about receiving this gift. We've seen what Jesus did to give us this gift. How do you receive that gift? What is your phrase there in verse 25? Propitiation in his blood through what? Through faith. Through faith. This is the way through which this justification is, and this propitiation are deposited into your account. Not by works, not by you doing something, but by the one who did the work for us. Through faith in Jesus. Our job is to trust to believe upon him, to place our trust in him, to view his sufficiency as all we need. Does it sound too good to be true? Absolutely it is. That's what makes it the gospel. That's what makes it the good news. Now look at this at the end of verse 25. What was the purpose of God doing this without you doing anything? See that at the end of verse 25? This was to demonstrate his righteousness. Now, the point of him doing this was to show you something. That word demonstrate is the word endeignumai in the Greek. We get our word index for it. What on your hand would have the index on it? What do you use your index finger for? To point. That's the idea. That's talking about demonstration here. He is pointing out something. By Jesus Christ dying for you, apart from anything that you did, apart from any of your performance, just by his alone, he's pointing out something. And he's demonstrating his righteousness. You see, the problem with salvation, the question that we're asking is, how can a holy God allow a violating criminal, a sinner, into his presence? That's not our problem. Our problem is how can a loving God, send a good person to hell? I mean, which is not even an issue biblically, but that's our issue. But the question here is, how can a just judge let us off the hook and still be just? All this we looked at, this justification, this propitiation, this gift that salvation is, what does it communicate to us about God? That he found a way to grant us eternal life and yet still be righteous at the same time. That's fascinating. Ask a California judge how they can get a proven murderer innocent without the judge becoming unjust. He'll go, there's no way. God found a way. God did it. The cross of Jesus vindicates God's righteousness. In other words, if you have a guy on death row and he is about to be executed for murder, there is always two camps protesting outside. Who are they? One camp is the murder victim's family. And what are they crying out for outside that execution chamber? Justice. Justice. I want to see justice served for what they did to my son or my daughter. But also outside that room, there's another camp, isn't there? There is the convict's family. And what are they crying for? Mercy. Please. Please don't do this to them. Please grant mercy. Please let them off, right? You have both of those. Both of those are there. If the law demands a life for a life, is that judge still just and righteous for executing that criminal? If that's what the law demands. Is he still just? Yes. In California, or let's go to Texas, and you're going to get death row or whatever, and a guy, the law, whether you like the law or not, if the law says a life for a life, is the just judge for executing that criminal for murdering somebody? Yes, if that's what the law demands. What if he lets him off? Is he still just? No. Unless he lays down his own life. If the law permitted within that he laid down his own life, then he could be both merciful and just. So it's that same idea that we looked at before. The cross demonstrates the righteousness of God in allowing a sinful man into the presence of God apart from his own works. It's demonstrating that. Folks, this is the deep magic of Narnia right here. All right? This is only what God can do. Now, at the end of verse 25, we see another reason behind God's motivations. He demonstrated his righteousness because in the forbearance of God, he passed over the sins previously committed. That word forbearance here means to delay or to hold back. In chapter 2, verse 4, remember, we're told that one of the reasons God delayed in judging people is so that in his kindness, people might have more time to repent. Right? We saw that. Well, here, we're told another reason why God holds back judgment. It is because he anticipated his provision for those sins in Jesus Christ. His forbearance was evidence of grace, not injustice. One of the criticisms of God is that because he didn't deal with evil, because he doesn't deal with evil, then he is unjust. But we know he's just being patient. If Jesus never came, if a penalty was never paid for man's sin, and God just letting man, just kept on letting man go in his own way, could we say God is unjust? I mean, in a hypothetical sense, yes, not in reality. But we have the cross. And on that cross, the penalty of sin was dealt with. And so what Paul is saying here is that the cross is actually a demonstration of God's justice, God's righteousness. Except here, instead of killing mankind for his sin, he chose to deal with it by handing over his own son. That's why God could pass over the sins of the past. Now, time out here. What question does this phrase that we just read seek to answer in the Bible that a lot of us have? You ever ask the question about Old Testament saints? How were you saved before Christ came? Anybody know? Anybody want to take a stab at it? Huh? Faith in what? In the Messiah to come? Yeah. How are you able to buy something today without actually paying for it right now?
Credit.
This is going to be the whole concept of chapter 4 of Abraham. How was Abraham saved? Saved by faith. And what did that faith do? What did it do? Somebody over here said it. It credited his account with righteousness. Same idea with a credit card. You can buy something ahead of time, can't you, in our currency? I pull out that little piece of plastic, take my Apple Pay, I can buy it. I don't even have to have the money right now. I don't even have to. It's fascinating. Some of y'all are really well familiar with this concept. Too familiar. But you can buy something on credit. Is there a time when that bill's going to come due, though? Oh, yeah. 30 days from now. 30 days from that purchase, that bill's going to come due. And if you don't pay then, somebody's coming after you, aren't they? In the same way, one of the reasons in God's forbearance is he had credited the account. Abraham believed in the promises of God. He believed that through him, through his seed, not seeds, but seed, according to Galatians 3, through the promise of the Messiah. Even though Abraham didn't quite have a name to that one yet, he didn't have all the details you and I do on this side of the cross. He believed that that's how God was going to save. He believed that that is how God's promise would be enacted. And by that faith, it was credited him as righteous. Now, when did that credit get paid? Didn't get paid in Abraham's lifetime. When did it get paid? According to Romans 3 here. At the cross. When Jesus died on the cross, he paid the bill for all those who believed upon him in faith, whose righteousness was credited to them. You and I are credited on the backside of the cross. It's like getting a credit card that's prepaid now. That's the difference now. You and I are issued a prepaid credit card. It was paid at a time previous before us, and now we are living off that credit that was already made to our account by faith. So that's one of the things that gets hinted at here a little bit. But that's exactly, and if you don't believe me, that's exactly what Jesus said of Abraham in John chapter 8. What did he say Abraham rejoiced to see? Remember that? Jesus said Abraham rejoiced in John 8 to see my day. That's what Abraham was waiting for, was Jesus to come. in Acts 17:30 says God had overlooked times of ignorance. It's kind of that idea. So Paul summarizes in verse 26 concerning the demonstration of God's righteousness. For the demonstration, I say, of his righteousness at the present time, so that he would be just and the justifier. Again, we have two opposing things here in this verse. That God might be just, that he would indeed inflict his wrath upon sin, but yet that he would also be the justifier, that his mercy would also save sinners. See how those two things come together? Those two tensions are met in Jesus. How does God demonstrate that he can do both? That he can justify and be the justifier? It's through the cross, by paying the penalty for us. But who is it that gets justified at the end of verse 26? The one who has faith in Jesus. Do you have anything to do with the accomplishment of salvation at Calvary? No. You simply believe upon it and receive it. Which leads to the natural rhetorical question by Paul in verse 27. Where then is the boasting? Where can you boast if salvation is by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone? Where can you boast? Is there any way that you can boast in your own merit? Paul says, no, it is excluded. In this scenario of God sending Jesus to die in our place as a gift so that we can receive his righteousness through faith in Jesus, can man brag about that righteousness as if he earned it? No, you can't. It's the same deal, man. I mean, this, it's like, y'all probably heard me say this, it's like Oprah's great giveaway, right? Let's just pretend for a moment, underneath one of your seats right now, there is a key to a brand new BMW outside. It's yours, right? All you have to do is go look under that, grab it. One of y'all, look under it. Some of y'all, actually, I'm just kidding. You look under there, and let's say you find the keys. You go outside and like, oh my gosh, you're giving me a free car. Yeah, it's yours, man. We've talked about this before. And then you go to me and go, man, that's too good to be true. Yes, it is too good to be true. Enjoy it. It's a gift. Man, I can't take this. You got to let me pay for it. Well, no, you pay for it. It's not a gift anymore. Come on, man. Something. At least, tell you what, will you just take a couple $1,000s for it? I mean, just as a token of my thanks. No. No, because then you'll own a couple $1,000s of this gift. And that this isn't yours to own. This is yours to receive. All right, come on, seriously. Let me at least, what's in my wallet? I got $2. Can I give you $2 for this? No, cheap thing. Get out of here. Because then you'll always own $2 of this. How about a penny? No, because then you'll always own a penny of it. I want this to be a door on to you. I want it to be a gift. You can't pay for it. It's got to be just received. That's what salvation is. It is a gift. Now, we cannot brag upon anything other than the grace of Christ. Our boast is in Jesus. That's why your testimony, when somebody asks you to share your testimony, if your first thing is, well, I've been good most of my life. You know, I grew up in a church home, a Christian home. Well, you know, I always went to Sunday school. What are you doing in your testimony? You're bragging about what you did. That's not your testimony. Your testimony is, I had nothing to do with anything. You know what I did? I sinned. That's what I did. I deserved wrath and condemnation. That's my testimony. My boast is in Jesus Christ. I've got no other story to tell than the one that's in him. It's in him. That's my testimony. That's your testimony if you've been saved by Jesus. It has nothing to do with you. It has nothing to do with you. We'll keep going here. Verse 27. By what kind of law? Is it a law of works? No, but a law of faith. Y'all notice what Paul called the gospel there? The law of faith. Today, there is only one requirement to be saved. There's only one law that you have to fulfill to be saved. And that is what was said in Acts chapter 4. There is no other name under heaven and earth that has been given to man by which they must be saved. As Paul then said later to the jailer, believe upon Jesus Christ. Confess with your mouth and believe in your heart that Jesus Christ is Lord, and you will be saved. That's the law. It's the law of faith. Why does he call it the law of faith? Because in verse 28, Paul is going to give you the creed of Romans. And he says this in verse 28. In fact, whenever you see the words we confess something, you're looking at a creed. This is what the early church believed. Verse 28, for we maintain that a man is justified, he's declared righteous, by faith apart from works of the law. That's your creed of Romans right there. That's what saves you. Another older translation, earlier King James, would translate it sola fide, by faith alone. Faith alone. Sola fide, Latin phrase there. Now, verse 29 and 30, another question. He says, or is God the God of the Jews only in this salvation? Is he not the God of the Gentiles also? Yes, the Gentiles also. Since indeed God, who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through faith, is one. What does that remind you of when you hear he's one? Anybody know? Y'all haven't made it to Deuteronomy, have you?
Ehad.
Huh?
One Ehad is in unity.
No.
Our God is...
This is the Shema.
Yeah, the Lord our God, the Lord is
yes,
God.
Deuteronomy chapter 6, the great Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one. The Lord our God is one. If you are saved by law, there's not two gods that save you, a God of law and a God of grace. There's only one God that saves you. It is the God of faith, the God of grace. He saves you. So Jew or Gentile, doesn't matter. It all comes by faith. Remember, there is no distinction. The playing field is leveled. Why is it important Paul uses verse 29 and 30? Based upon where we've been. Because in chapter 1 and 2, he's talking about Gentiles and why they deserve condemnation, and the Jews going, He's going, no, you're under the same condemnation, Jew. And now he's saying, if you come by faith, you're both saved the same. There's no distinction. Yeah.
Can you just go a little bit into, is there a definition by the word by faith and through faith?
All pointing to the same thing, but yes, all true. It's the same way in Colossians where Jesus, the world, was created by him and for him and through him, right? It's all his sovereignty in it. So, and Paul's going to use these interchangeably, his phrases, through faith or by faith. It's the same thing. It's all pointing to the fact that your trust is not in the law. It's not in your own works. It's apart from the law. But it is through faith or by faith. It's a means for and is the process of trusting in Jesus to find your salvation. That's the idea. Now, lastly, in verse 31, do we then nullify the law through faith? The idea here is, so can we just throw the law away? Is the law worthless now? Guess we don't need the Ten Commandments, right? Because the Jew would have been thinking, oh, I had to do all those things. You're saying, I don't have to, I just need to believe upon Jesus. We just throw the law away. No. Are we invalidating the law? No. Not at all. And he says, what does he say here in verse 31? Heck no, right? Meganoita. May it never be. On the contrary, we prove the law to be true. We establish the law in verse 31. Because what is the law? First of all, what is the law? The law is the perfect representation of the nature and character and the holiness of God. So we're going to throw that away? No. It's also the standard of God's righteousness. Are we going to throw that away? No. The law is, still has meaning. The penalty of the law is death. The prophecy of the law is Jesus. The purpose of the law is to drive me to Jesus. So the law is a good thing. If the law only existed to show you your sin and put you on your knees in dependency upon Jesus Christ to save you, then the law is worth every penny. So according to verse 27 through 31, what can we conclude about man being justified by faith through Jesus Christ alone and apart from works? Three things. Verse 27, boasting is excluded. Verse 29 and 30, God is exalted. And verse 31, the law is established. That's what we can conclude from justification by faith. Boasting is excluded, God is exalted, the law is established. Praise be to God. Now, right here, for the Jew, they got hung up on the Old Testament saints who went to heaven before Christ ever came. They might still have some objections to salvation by faith. They're going to look back and go, no, hadn't it always been by works? Didn't they have the law? That's what they had to do, right? And what Paul's going to do here in chapter 4 is he's going to give us an illustration of chapter 3. That man is justified by faith alone. And it's always been this way. Because if man is justified by faith as a free gift apart from works, then what about the Jews? Are they, by definition, a nation of law? Then how could they have been justified? And Paul says, good question. Let's start with the chief representative of Israel. Let's start with your forefather, Abraham. Let me show you how faith in Christ justified him as well. That's what Paul's going to do here. Abraham, by the way, he's a pretty big deal. Not sure if you know that from your Old Testament. Abraham is used in the book of James as a picture of works, of godly works. He's used in Romans and Galatians as a picture of faith. He's used in Hebrews as a picture of sacrifice. You have three cultures right now, religions, in a sense, that identify Abraham as their father. Who are they? All three are in Israel. Yep. Muslims, Christians, and Jews all identify Abraham as kind of being the father, the early forefather. He is the most significant human being other than Jesus Christ who's probably ever walked this earth in terms of what came through him. Abraham is the constitutional father of Israel. They biologically, and the true Israel by faith, stem from him. But here's Paul's point in this section. Let me ask you this. If you've got a constitutional problem in our country, who do you need to ask? Yeah, ultimately, you know what you're going to need to do? You're going to need to go ask Jefferson, right, and the boys. You're going to have to go back to the original forefathers to understand the Constitution. If you've got a problem with constitutional law, our Supreme Court is who represents them, supposedly, right now. Same way, if you've got an argument with faith and works from your Old Testament, who do you need to go ask to clarify it? Abraham. We got to go back to the constitutional forefather. What happened here? Look at this in chapter 4, verse 1. What then shall we say? That Abraham, our forefather, according to the flesh, has found. That's an interesting phrase, by the way, here in the Greek. In the Greek. If you have an NAS Bible, New American Standard, the way they read it is funny, as I just read it. If you read it, it sounds like the word flesh is modifying the word forefather. Abraham, our forefather, according to the flesh. That's how it sounds like. A literal reading is this, and actually the NIV gets it right. What has Abraham, our forefather, found concerning the flesh? See the difference there? So the argument here is focused on flesh, works, trying to earn salvation by law. That's the context here. And so in context, in light of chapter 3, verse 27, Paul's asking, what has Abraham found concerning what it means to be justified by works and then boasting in your own works? What has he found? Verse 2. For if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. I love that. Point being, chapter 3, verse 27 is exempted if you can find somewhere in the Bible that Abraham boasted in his own flesh, that he boasted in his own ability to save himself. Paul says here, hypothetically, if he was justified by works, he could boast before men, but he could never boast before God. But in verse 3, Paul proves that he didn't boast in justification by works by taking us to the Scriptures, and he's going to quote here from Genesis 15. For what does the Scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. Ooh. He introduces a word here that the earlier chapter didn't tell us. I told you about it, but the chapter didn't say it itself. Concerning how all the benefits of Christ are applied to the Old Testament saints who believed. And it's an old bookkeeper's term called credited. Right? And that's how it works. Just the mechanical act of faith doesn't change you, just believing intellectual assent. It's behind that faith, there has to be an act by God which takes from one account and transfers it to another. You have to have something applied to you in order to be saved. You have to be taken out of Adam and placed into Christ in order to be saved. Abraham believes, that's faith. And then what God does with that faith is he credits, or literally reckons. We get the term imputed as well. And he credits that account. Abraham believed what God promised. And on the basis of Abraham's belief or his trust, God imputes or credits his account. We see this every day. In common life. The school calls me, tells me my daughter is out of lunch money in her account. And so I take the money, which I have sweated to earn, broke my back teaching you all so I can buy her lunch, and I take money out of my account and I transfer it to her account in the school. The bank subtracts it from me, and the bank adds it to her. Did she do anything to make that happen? No, she didn't. Just made mess all over our floor. She didn't do anything. But yet my works are credited to her as if she earned them. See, this is not an imaginary works. She can literally take that money out, and she can go get some nasty old fish sticks, all right? That's what she can do with it if she wants. That's what imputation is. It is crediting. It is judiciously and realistically taking from one person's account and applying it to another so that they can act upon it as if it were theirs, because it is. That's how Abraham was justified. God pointed to the stars, and he said to Abraham, "So shall your descendants be." And Abraham believed that. He said, through your seed, that's referring to Jesus Christ. Galatians 3 tells us that. And through your seed, I'm going to bless the nations. Abraham believed that. He believed all those promises. And he believed out of the deadness of his body would come a people. And one of those people was going to be the promised one who would bless the nations. Abraham believed that. The object of his faith was not fully defined, but he believed in that promise still, and he was credited righteousness that he didn't deserve or earn. Now, in verse 4, Paul's going to apply all this. He's not speaking of Abraham here anymore. He's going to speak propositionally about human beings. And he's going to tell us here in verse 4, if you're a certain kind of person, then you're not of Abraham. He says, now to the one who works, his wage is not credited as a favor, but as what is due. Is that true, by the way? For those of you who grab a paycheck every pay period, are you given those checks as just a token of your employer's thankfulness? Just so glad for who you are. You know what? I'm going to give you a paycheck this week. Is that how that comes? No. What did you do to get that paycheck? You earned it. You worked. You earned a wage. You get that paycheck not because of grace or because of a favor, but because you earned it. And so in verse 4, what kind of person is not of Adam? The one who works. In verse 5, here's what it takes to, Abraham. In verse 5, here's what it takes to be of Abraham. Three things. Haddon Robinson, by the way, called this the finest single verse in the entire Bible. Right here on salvation by faith. Verse 5. But to the one, notice these three things. To the one who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, then his faith is credited as righteousness. See those three things right there? Three things you have to do to find this salvation. First thing you have to do is you have to be ungodly. Anybody fit that bill? Anybody? All right. Yeah, some of y'all. The rest of y'all are all godly. First thing you have to do is you have to be ungodly. Second thing is you can't work for it. And instead, thirdly, you're going to have to believe. Those are the three things. Justification by faith, salvation by faith. That's the contrast to verse 4. In verse 4, if you and I earn anything, it's chapter 2, verse 8, the wrath of God, indignation. Paul would say in verse 4, that's what is due. But in verse 5, Paul says, no, be like Abraham. Recognize your sinfulness, your unworthiness. Recognize that you can't earn and deserve it on your own. Secondly, quit pursuing the works of your flesh, which are like dirty rags. And third, instead, believe in what God has done for you through the person and work of Jesus Christ. Now in verse 6, Paul says, oh, Abraham, not enough for you? The forefather of your faith, not enough? Well, how about the guy you epitomized as the greatest king of your nation? Who would that be? Scan the text. Who are we talking about? David. Just as David also speaks of the blessing on the man to whom God reckons righteousness apart from works. Now, why use David as an illustration? What's the key difference between Abraham and David in context? Anybody know? Abraham was before the law. David came after the law. Abraham was one whose righteousness was his. David is one whose sin was not his. Do you see the two sides of it? Both of them had imputation. Abraham had imputed merit. David had imputed or non-imputed demerit. That's the idea there. One came before the law, one came after the law. Abraham was credited what wasn't his. David, whose sin should have been counted against him, wasn't by faith. So the both sides of this, faith. Faith before the law, faith after the law, it was always faith. In verse 7 and 8, this is taken from the text in which David had just sinned with Bathsheba, and he rejoices in why he is blessed. It is not because he is good, but because God does not reckon his sin to him, but rather forgives him. In other words, how was David saved? He was saved by faith. Look at this in verse 7 and 8. Blessed are those whose lawless deeds have been forgiven, whose sins have been covered, atoned for. Blessed is the man whose sin the Lord will not take into account. Literally, who will never reckon or credit his sins against him. just as God was gracious enough to give Abraham something he didn't earn, in the same way, God was gracious enough to not give David something he deserved. You know what we call these two terms? Grace and mercy. Grace is receiving something you didn't earn, i.e. Abraham. Mercy is not receiving something you did earn, i.e. David. Paul's showing both sides of this here. So, two men, one before the law, one after the law, both trusted God to save and not in themselves. So in verses 1 through 8, we are saved apart from works. And he uses some Old Testament guys to show you that. Now in verses 9 through 12, he's going to show how man is saved not just apart from works, but a specific work, apart from circumcision. Now remember, it was held in Israel that a Jew might not be as good as he should be, but God would never condemn him if he was circumcised. If he had the sign of the covenant on him, God would never condemn him. We've already seen in chapter 2, that is not the case. But here, Paul uses Abraham again as an example. Look at this. Verse 9. Is the blessing then on the circumcised or the uncircumcised also? For we say faith was credited to Abraham as righteousness. Meaning, can an uncircumcised man be justified by faith? Paul says, you bet he can. What's his proof here? Does he say circumcision was credited to him as righteousness? No, he is saved here by what? Faith. Faith. In verse 10, which came first, circumcision or faith? How then was it credited? While he was circumcised or uncircumcised? It was not while he was circumcised, but while he was uncircumcised. In other words, Abraham was declared righteous by God in Genesis 15. He wasn't circumcised until Genesis 17. So tell me something. When was Abraham saved? Did his circumcision save him? No. He was saved 13 years before he was circumcised. Abraham was saved by faith a whole 13 years before the sign of the covenant ever came into play. So don't miss this. If you're a Jew, if you're one who thinks you can be saved by your own works, and Paul just dropped a soteriological bomb on you right here, that Abraham was a believer and he was saved apart from circumcision. And in verse 11, Paul wants to argue what circumcision was in the first place. Two things he tells us in verse 11. He received the sign of circumcision, which was secondly, a seal of the righteousness of faith, which he had while uncircumcised. That's what circumcision is. It is both a sign and a seal. It is not a means to justify. Question, what is a sign? A sign is an external picture of an internal reality. It signifies something. It points to a greater reality. That's what a sign does. The sign itself is not the reality. It points to the reality. What signs do we have as ordinances of our faith? What signs corporately do we use that signify our faith? Got them. Communion and baptism are two signs. One might call it a sacrament, not in the Catholic sense, but in a sign sense. They testify to the fact of an internal reality. It's an external sign that points to an internal reality. When I get baptized, it's not so that baptism saves me. It's showing what has saved me, which was my faith in Jesus Christ, and it's illustrating it. Same thing with my wedding band. We've already talked about this. My wedding band is not my marriage. It's a sign of my marriage, but it's not my marriage. And then communion as well. When we take of the broken body and the shed blood as remembrances, not of actuality, not as an actual act of Eucharist where this is the Christ blood and body. That's a heresy in the Catholic Church. It is a sign. Take this in remembrance of me, not an actuality of me. It's a sign. What's a seal? A seal is a certainty. When you put a seal on an envelope, when you take that signet ring, which was a sign, a signet ring, and you would dip it in wax, and you would seal it, that was to authenticate it so that it would get to its destination as promised. It was a seal of its contents. It certifies that its contents are indeed from the king and that it will arrive there, not manipulated by anybody else. When you and I get saved, when we put our faith in Jesus Christ, God sealed us, according to Ephesians 1, with what? The Holy Spirit. He is the seal of his covenant. He is the down payment. He's not only the power source and that which gives us life, but he's also the down payment of our salvation that we are still waiting upon its ultimate completion in Jesus Christ in the day of our redemption. And his Spirit is a seal that certifies we are his and will get to its destination. Circumcision was a seal and a sign given by God. In other words, in verse 11, what was it a seal of? What does it certify? That righteousness came by faith. That's what circumcision was telling the story of. Not that the act of cutting away flesh is what saved you, but it's pointing to the fact that you put your faith in a greater promise. And so, if Jesus doesn't come, your faith ultimately, if Jesus never came, your faith wouldn't save you. He is the one who made it come true at Calvary. So likewise, circumcision becomes a certainty of that promise. Yeah.
So if that applied to Abraham, that circumcision was a sign and a seal of his faith, did that also apply to the rest of Israel who was circumcised, that they also had faith and that was sealed?
No, that's what its intention was. It didn't mean that's how everybody took it. So what became customary? On the eighth day, you did what? Circumcised your sons. Did every single Jew do that? Yes. But it doesn't mean that every single Jew is a believer. And Paul's going to argue that when we get into Romans 9, 10, and 11. He's going to say, not all Israel is Israel. So it never was meant to be that. That was a stumbling block for them, just like they did with the law. The law was never meant to save you, but they all took it that way. Same thing with circumcision. And so this circumcision was a God swearing. Of all the places that God could put a sign and a seal, he put it on the male penis, on the sexual organ of a man. It's God swearing, I promise to you that from your loins, Abraham, will come the seed, the Messiah. I promise you that. But it's on the basis of your faith that I'm crediting this as righteous, not on the basis of this seal. So the act of circumcision was never meant to save, but to be a sign and a seal. Where did you get all this, by the way? All this argument is Galatians 3. Just go bathe in Galatians 3, and you can see the promise of all this. So y'all dig? Y'all following so far? Now, let's just finish this real quick. He says in verse 11, all this so that he might be the father of all who believe without being circumcised, that righteousness might be credited to them. Men today are circumcised for hygienic reasons. But if we weren't, could Abraham still be our father? Yes, he is. If you have come by faith in Jesus Christ, then Abraham is your father. So you mean it's possible to be a Jew who is practicing the works of the law as a means of salvation and Abraham not be your father? Absolutely. What did Jesus say to the Jew? Abraham's not your father. Your father is the devil. Good night. Right? Not a good thing, by the way. It's a tip-off that maybe you're maybe heading the wrong direction there. Verse 12, who else is the father? He's also the father of circumcision to those who not only are of the circumcision, but who also follow in the steps of the faith of our father Abraham, which he had while uncircumcised. So you're a Jew. Your being Jew doesn't save you. Your being circumcised doesn't save you. Your faith is what saves you. And if you come by faith, then you can call Abraham your father. But if you don't have faith in Jesus, but rather you're practicing the works of the law, but you're circumcised, Abraham's not your daddy. He's not your forefather. Your father's the devil. Your father's the devil because you're practicing an unrighteous means of salvation, which is no salvation at all. So you see what he's doing there? It's been by faith through faith. This is what he meant in Romans 1. From faith to faith, from beginning to end, it has always come by faith. There you go. Now, we'll come back tomorrow. We'll jump back in. We'll look at a little bit more of the implications of Abraham in our salvation. Y'all got saved today. Did y'all put your faith in Jesus alone? Hallelujah. You're saved. You're free. Go and preach the gospel. Don't be ashamed. See y'all tomorrow.